This podcast is brought to you by lineupmedia.fm.
Welcome to Follow the Sound. I am your host, Brian Kroc. Each week, we try to bring you the best of music history for our segment, This Week in Music History. This week, we'll be covering June 26th through June 30th, a pretty good week, if I do say so myself. And to help me out on this show is, of course, my co-host, Jacob Crum.
We can't build our dreams on suspicious minds.
And I have brought on another friend of ours, Carl Stegeman.
But I think we can.
Dun, dun, dun. So Carl here is our young friend. How old are you, Carl? I forgot.
23 in less than a month.
See, 23 in less than a month. So he's quite a bit younger than the rest of us.
Don't worry. I'm going to be on my birthday this year. I'm going to drive around blasting Blink-182's What's My Age Again.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
That'll be good.
Yeah.
A few weeks ago, we did a Blink-182 review, and that turned out to be quite fun because it was like...
Did you just say that over and over again because it rhymes?
No.
I would have.
So Carl here is just a good friend of ours. I've known him for the better part of a decade.
Yeah.
And I know Jake's known him just from we hang out in some of the same circles and stuff. And so Carl's always been kind of like the cool... almost little brother type person who is hanging around in our group.
Well, as it's been described to me by multiple people within your group.
Yes.
Our group, I
our
should
group,
say.
Our group, yes.
Yeah. No one really knows, like, I guess I'm like the Big Bang in the sense that no one really knows where I came from.
You just,
I just showed up one day.
And then you were hanging out and it was like, hey, here's this redheaded kid. Okay. But Carl is a musician, right? You play bass and...
Bass, drums, a little bit of guitar.
Yeah, a little bit of guitar.
I used to be able to sing, but now I can only really screech out punk rock vocals.
There you go. But I've always liked having Carl because we have some fascinating music conversations. Because despite him being, you know, 10 plus years younger than Jake and I, he is very advanced for his years as far as his love of music. And so I wanted to bring him on for an album review, which we will get to after this show, but we're going to get to our music history show first, starting with June 26th. Mm-hmm. Jake, kick us off.
Let's go back a little more than a century, starting out 1870. Wagner's Ride of the Valkyries is played for the first time at the National Theater in Munich. Wagner's best-known piece, of course, is from the opera Die Valkyrie.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me, Die Valkyrie. And do you know any other? Can you name any other Wagner pieces?
Man, I don't know
off
them offhand.
Off the top of
your
head?
No, okay. I could. I
There's
could
one you
them,
know but... very well.
Oh, I know a bunch of them. I know them just by listening to them, but I don't know their names offhand.
There's one I think everyone's heard. The Bridal Chorus.
Oh, that was Wagner, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's from Lohengrin, which is actually a opera based on a what was like a couple hundred year old poem at the time, a French poem. Anyway,
fascinating.
So there you go.
So Wagner is an interesting cat in music history because not only did he produce basically the best German music, like in the 1800s. I mean, people will talk about Mozart doing his thing or, you know, like some of the other people. And I know there are other great German composers, but Wagner was just, he created this supremely epic sound in his operas.
Well, even at the time, he was really kind of pushing Paris as like trying to reset the center of culture in Europe.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And it's funny to think about, but was the cutting edge of opera at the time.
Yeah. And I mean, most of the stuff that he wrote that he came
Wagner
up with
was an edgelord, guys.
Oh man!
So the most of the stuff that he came up with,
and Mozart
though, like
was
he
a meme lord.
He got it while living in places like Austria and like being inspired by some of these old Germanic mythologies, and so that's why he ended up writing the operas that he did. And of course, I mean, he was well loved in his time.
Mm-hmm.
He was sponsored by like a duke or something, so he could basically live out his days.
Well,
however,
that was kind
to.
Of like any artist that made it at the time was
yeah.
just like
kinda,
sponsored by
a patron. That's what it was
yeah.
called.
Yeah.
A patron.
I wish that was still a thing.
So yeah, when musicians are sponsored, they're called labels now. That's
well, labels aren't
you've got
quite
crowdfunding.
Labels
got
yeah,
Patreon.
Crowdfunding. So, yeah. So he did his thing, and I think only at one particular time he published something in a paper or a letter or something, which basically was slamming Jews. But it was essentially him just being pissed off because these two other Jewish composers were getting popular and he didn't, you know, it's like old school, like
yeah.
slamming
yeah.
Justin Bieber
right.
because
kind
he's
of
popular.
Like, kind
right.
of, it's
but he was
sort
just
of the
like,
equivalent
those
of Elvis,
Jews.
Kind of the equivalent of Elvis bashing the Beatles while he was off saying that they took advantage of him, like joining the army and
yeah.
Yeah.
It'd be like Bruce Springsteen slamming Justin Bieber because he's Canadian.
Yeah.
So,
but either. And then of
I
course
mean,
that was co-opted by
we
the brown shirts.
We have so many more better reasons to slam Justin Bieber.
The Nazis.
Yeah. So, but then that's the bad part is that Wagner was yeah. was a huge deal for Hitler, and he used to play Wagner's music to the troops, like at their big rallies and stuff like that.
Like, well,
and he
like,
said every true German should listen to Wagner.
Wasn't
he's
one
like,
of the like there's that whole. There's the documentary about Hitler and like you know his war propaganda and everything like Ride of the Valkyries was like. The war propaganda song
yes.
for him, wasn't it?
I mean, and actually at the time when they were doing the national anthem for Nazi Germany, I mean, like, it was all, like, it was based off of Wagner. So, I mean, it was just, it was kind of
crazy. It is powerful music.
But it's very powerful mm-hmm. music, which is exactly why he used
yeah.
it.
It just was used in the wrong place
yes.
for a little while.
Yes. And so, I mean, it is what it is. Hitler also used writings from Martin Luther, like that Martin Luther had written at the end of his life. It's like to justify his
I'm
stuff.
I'm sure
so.
My Lutheran friends would love to hear that.
Well, it's yeah. a true statement. Most Lutherans, though, most yeah. Lutherans fully accept that, though.
Yeah,
they're like,
yeah.
well, you know, it's like we obviously respect Martin Luther,
but
he did do this. It's
right.
like, you know, so there yeah. is that. Most Lutherans that I've met are actually super cool about it. They're not like. You know, oh no, our leaders are completely above reproach. Like, we can't criticize them for any. It's like, nope, Martin Luther was pretty cool, but he did
yeah.
some bad things too.
Yeah.
So,
and just a really quick plug, if you ever want to get the skinny on Wagner and his music and
the
why
skinny.
It's important, yeah, the skinny, why it's important, or why some people find it important, you see the documentary Wagner and Me with Stephen Fry,
yes.
Yeah. Oh, Stephen Fry did that?
Fascinating
yeah, yeah.
documentary.
I've heard about
and
the
you get some really good back scene, or behind the scenes footage of Wagner, of Die Valkyrie being put together.
Yeah.
So you get to see like what a Valkyrie looks like in street clothes with just the wings standing
oh,
on stage
awesome.
In a dress rehearsal.
They do it every year. It's called Wagner Days.
Mm, yes.
Mm-hmm.
They perform it in the theater that was basically built for him.
Yes.
And like they made this thing
the
so
the National
perfect.
Theater in Munich. It's still around.
Yes,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
So they made this thing so acoustically like perfect that they didn't even put padding on the seats. Because they knew that it would mess with the sound.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So whenever you go there, you have to, like, mm-hmm. bring a cushion. Or you can, like, rent
but
one.
But it'll ruin the sound, Brian.
No, you're sitting on the cushion. Not, it's like, trust me, like, they were very, like, the seats themselves, like, haven't been changed.
Oh, man.
It's amazing. It's like, I love that. So,
let's go to the opera bleachers.
Funnily enough, I was actually watching another Stephen Fry documentary before I came here. So it was him promoting his new book. He had some fascinating stories about mm-hmm. like meeting Prince Charles and Princess
yeah.
Diana and like.
I've been. He had a show, there's a show of his on Netflix right now too.
Oh, I'm
the one
sure
where he tours the U.S.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
I've seen that one actually. That
one's pretty great.
Was a good one. I don't know how we devolved into that, but Stephen Fry is one of my favorite dudes
well,
in the U.K.
Stephen yes. Fry, he is the best of us. Don't you know that, Brian?
That is true. He is a giant gay man.
Well, he's the best example of just what a genuine good human being should be.
Yeah, I'll agree with that.
At least English speaking, anyway. But moving on.
Yes. Although in the one where he tours the U.S., I completely hated mm-hmm. his thing when he goes through St. Louis. Because it was all just
yeah,
like,
yeah.
really, it's like the one thing you're going to focus on is like the homelessness in St. Louis.
Well, I mean, when you're looking at what people, a lot of people consider to be the bastion of success and, you know, just
But not no mention of like, you know, going for Lewis and Clark or like any of that kind of stuff. But
that's the choices you make as a filmmaker.
Yeah, anyway, no mention true. Of the,
I'll take this
giant
one.
Go ahead for the next one. Right. Says,
since these notes are nonsensical to anyone but me.
Well, no, it's just that I'm going to preface this now. We have several stories that involve not the person here, but the person that the person was involved with over the next hour. So, Jake, get us started with things involving Elvis.
Here we go. 1909. Colonel Tom Parker is born in Breda, Netherlands. The manager, longtime, actually, I think his only manager of Elvis, is a very controversial figure. And at some point during Elvis's career, he managed to take half of Elvis's money. He was getting like a 50% commission. And lived a very ripe old age, dying in 1997 at 98.
So Colonel Tom Parker, of course, the only reason why he got into recording in the first place was because he was like, hey, I can make money off of this. Mm-hmm. And originally, all he did was record black artists.
Yeah.
But he knew. He's like, if I can find a white guy who sounds like these people, I can make money off of him.
Well, you know how Elvis was discovered, right?
Elvis went in to record at Sun Studios.
Yeah, he went to record a single for his mother for Mother's Day.
And I've heard like the very first recordings that he did. And he didn't do That's All Right Mama first.
No.
He did like a couple of other ones and it's all slow and ballad like, and you know, and all of that. And then like,
he did a rock tune.
Yeah. And then they were like, you know, well, what else do you have? And Tom Parker was just like, this guy can sing, but he's not singing anything good. And then they said like, he started doing That's All Right Mama and it was all just like, oh, good Lord. Like, and that's when he knew. He's like, I found my golden ticket, you know, but I tell you what, he did find some great freaking talent in a very short period of time, because he had Elvis, he had freaking Carl Perkins, that one douchebag piano player.
Jerry Lee Lewis.
Yeah.
And of course, then Johnny Cash coming in and
well, speaking of the history of St. Louis, Jerry Lee Lewis, he opened for Chuck Berry one time.
Yes.
And he despised the fact that he was opening for somebody else to the point that he set his piano on fire and pulled a pre-Hendrix and then walked off stage and told Chuck Berry to follow that. So.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
Yeah, really the quintessential asshole of the 20th century.
But it's okay.
Chuck Berry went out there and frickin' did his little steppy thing across the stage and everybody went crazy.
And everybody went nuts for it. So, yeah, I just think.
Doing his little duck walk and
that's
all
one of
that.
My favorite stories, though.
Because you know Chuck Berry wasn't going to stand for that.
Oh, no. No.
Chuck Berry was a showman.
Like, he very much was.
Like, oh, you're going to set your piano on fire? Whoop-de-doo. It's like,
I strut across the stage better than you.
And I will show you this. Yeah, so let's see.
And we all know
moving.
Johnny B. Goode came from, you know, Michael J. Fox, so.
Another one here. Speaking of St. Louis, though, 1938, Billy Davis Jr. Woo. Of Fifth Dimension is born in St. Louis, Missouri. Woo! That's all I got for that one.
Yeah, not a big Billy Davis Jr. fan?
I'm not a huge, like, Billy Davis Jr. or Fifth Dimension fan. Mm. It is what it is.
My great-grandmother had a gospel album by him.
Yeah?
Oh, yeah?
That's what I think of Billy Davis Jr. Like when I think of him, I think of my great grandmother, like sitting down, listening. It was like that. And
like, did he sound like your great grandmother?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, but it's just her collection of gospel albums.
Yeah, that's fair.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Ooh.
So here we go.
Ooh.
Here's one that I truly like. 1965, The Byrds go to number one on the U.S. singles chart with their version of Bob Dylan's "Mr. Tambourine Man." Let's see. Only Roger McGuinn from the band played on the song. The drummer, Hal Blaine, who played on the track, also played on Bridge Over Troubled Water, which was pretty cool.
Oh, wow.
But
the
Mr. Tambourine Man, of course, by the Byrds. The Byrds are sort of a goofy band in the first place because it's got these different people in there that, of course, have gone on to do like a bunch of other stuff, including David Crosby, who Crosby, Stills, Nash, and sometimes Young. So they did their thing. Great guitar sound, great feeling like in the band. But when they were supposed to go play in the UK, they marketed them as, you know, like the US's response to the Beatles.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And the Byrds are just like, no, we're not. It's like, we're just a band, and we just want to play music. And so, like, they didn't understand that marketing them as that would piss off a lot of people, mainly Beatles fans, which was the exact demographic they were trying to shoot for.
Yep.
And so it was like, it's like just crash and burn. But actually, if you go back and you watch some of the early interviews of the Beatles, you'll see, like, David Crosby standing in the background. And one of the reporters goes, "Who's that man standing behind you?" And they go, "Oh, that's David."
Yeah, they knew each other.
Yeah, and so it's like they were all friends. Like, the Birds and the Beatles became friends.
I was just going to suggest we should make a documentary called The Birds and the Beatles.
The Birds and the Beatles. That would have been a great tour either way.
Oh,
so.
For sure.
But yeah, no, it's the Birds were just a fascinating group, and I've really enjoyed their music. They really were good at utilizing the 12-string electrics.
Oh, yeah. I've honestly not listened to nearly enough of them. Like, everything I've heard by them, I've loved.
Yeah.
But I need to listen to more.
Yeah.
So I'm just gonna like, nudge you in the arm and be like, "Hey, Brian, I need some music."
And I got another one here. 1974.
Oh, man.
This is fascinating, too.
Is it?
Cher divorced Sonny Bono after 10 years of marriage. Of course, Sonny and Cher being the fantastic duo from the TV show who produced a bunch of great songs. 4 days later, though, Cher married Greg Allman.
Oh, man.
Divorced Sonny Bono.
Marries Greg Allman.
Marries Greg Allman 4 days later. And the couple split 10 days after that, and then got back together, then broke up again.
Stayed married for 3 years.
Then they stayed married for 3 years, and they produced one child, Elijah Blue Allman.
So how much of that do you think was just a publicity stunt?
None of it.
Dang. I know, like, that must have been, like,
none
that must have been
it.
Crazy for the tabloids for a while, though. I mean,
it's incredibly fascinating just because, like, I mean, one, I always kind of had a soft spot for Sonny Bono for some reason. It's like, I always thought he was a cool dude. It's like, you know, and he got into politics later on, and then he tragically died in that skiing accident, which was like, what the crap? How do you die in a skiing accident? And then it's like, is it an avalanche or something? No, he hit a tree. Oh, how? It happens a lot more often than that. I mean, Liam Neeson's wife
got
killed.
She got a concussion and
died.
Kennedy too. I think there was a Kennedy.
One of the Kennedys. Yeah, I don't remember. Like,
of course, they were skiing and throwing a football back and forth, like the reckless, abandoned Americans that they are.
They probably weren't even doing that. They were probably just hunting black people. Yeah, I said it. The Kennedys were horrible racists. No, I'm kidding.
I mean, I wasn't going to say it.
All of a sudden, it's going to appear on some conspiracy theory show. I need to contact Everett Surreal Talk.
I listened to Follow the Sound last night, and they said...
I'm going to post it on the Surreal Talk page. Be like, just listen at this point where I have definitive proof that the Kennedys hunted black people in the woods of Northern Canada.
I'm vetoing this story because I don't want Ted Kennedy memes to come back.
It'd be like the Harambe memes whenever the zoo, when the Cincinnati Zoo was like, "Can you please stop this?" And
I'd forgotten about that. Now,
I'm sorry.
Well, here's a conspiracy that won't go away, Brian.
Got it. What? Go.
1977 on this day, Elvis Presley plays his last show in Indianapolis, Indiana. Yes.
In Indianapolis.
Were you now?
Yeah.
But no, it was his twin. Haven't you watched the Lifetime movie?
Yeah, not so much. The show didn't go very well. He made it about halfway through before just being disjointed by the cocktail of intoxicants that he was on, forced his the showrunners to pull him off stage.
Yep.
And they canceled later's tour, and I think 2 or 3 days later, they found him dead. So
yeah. So it well known that that Elvis had his vices, mainly being drugs.
Oh yeah.
But once again, I mean, if you ever see any of the documentaries about Elvis, like, you learn that he was really a man of extremes. He was extreme with like the drugs and stuff. It's like when he was cool with people, he was really cool with people. It's like, you know, he would go above and beyond a lot of times. Man was devoutly Christian exceptionally which is, spiritual, which is well, really kind of
crazy. It depends
crazy.
On whose book you're reading, because then, who was it? His handler, I can't remember his name now, a guy, it doesn't matter. But anyway, he describes Elvis as being a narcissist who would lay down on the top of his Cadillac and explode clouds with his mind, or at least he thought so. He was a cloud burster.
Yeah, no. I mean, but that's a lot of the stuff that's also like dealing with drugs. So,
well, maybe, or he could have just been a weirdo. I mean,
yeah, he could have been a weirdo.
He was one of what, 13 children?
No, he was one of one.
One, okay.
I was wondering one where he got child. 13 from.
So,
but if you've watched the Lifetime movie.
The Lifetime movie, yes, where his twin brother actually survived and was raised by a pastor.
A pastor, and then...
A traveling pastor.
Yeah.
Because they couldn't raise two kids with Vern and them. But there's actually another documentary. I know we've been talking a lot about documentaries today, but there's another documentary on Netflix, I believe it's still there, called Orion. You get a chance, check this out, because it was the man who, with the voice of Elvis...
Okay.
And it was this guy who, you know, he grew up, and when he started singing, sounded exactly like Elvis. And I'm saying, like, when I listen to it and I've got a discerning ear, dude sounded exactly like Elvis.
Now, we're not talking like Michael Bublé who just covers Sinatra.
No.
We're talking
like
I'm
talking
sounds.
Like legitimately sounds like Elvis. Like the fact that, Queen has tried to have different singers to replace Freddie Mercury.
It can't
and
be
it doesn't
done.
Matter. It doesn't matter like who they brought on. Nobody can really replace Freddie Mercury.
Right.
Then they found this one dude who was a Canadian singer. Dude sounded exactly like him.
But that
I
was,
mean,
that was,
freakishly good.
That was years later, though, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was many, many years later. So the same thing. This dude grows up. He does his whole thing. He tries to make a legit go in the music industry. But everybody says, you sound like Elvis. Why would I want to buy your stuff when I can buy Elvis's stuff? Even to the point where when Elvis died, this guy actually recorded tracks and then they were released as Elvis songs, and yet he recorded them.
Oh, wow.
And like crazy stuff like that. So the weird thing, though, is that he was raised by his mother, and his mother never told him who his father was. But later on, they found out, they found like his birth certificate, and it said that his... father was a man named Vernon who lived in Mississippi.
Oh.
And so they're suspecting that this dude was like the illegitimate son of Vernon Presley and like this dude's mother. And like I never actually followed it up. I didn't know if they actually tried to do DNA testing or something like that. But the dude's son was really, really trying to.
Well,
like,
that ought to be easy. You can buy Elvis hair in a jar or
I'm
a pimple
sure that's
at
real.
Every five and dime store. So it should be
honestly
easy
the easiest way to actually do that would be to get DNA from Elvis's daughter.
Have you ever seen those? Like, I remember Grandpa Pigeons used to sell these like
Elvis hair.
No, they and pimples. They.
These hand little, pimples.
Yeah, I shit you not. These little pimples and like these little bitty jars that they said were pimples. It could have been tips of an eraser for all I know.
Yeah. So,
I just
yeah.
don't know why you'd preserve pimples.
Right. I'm just saying that even like as a 5-year-old when I saw those, I'm like, that's complete bullshit. Like, there's no way that's Elvis's hair.
But oh, man, I'm so glad you were a smart 5-year-old.
Since we were speaking of Vernon Presley and the possible illegitimate son that he had.
Here we go.
Once again, check out the documentary Orion. It is really interesting. So,
but also speaking of Vernon Presley.
1979.
Yes. 1979.
Just short of 2 years after Elvis's death, his father, Vernon... Vernon E. Presley. Vernon Elvis Presley died of heart failure at the age of 63.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty young.
Yep.
Well, pretty young. So there you go. We don't talk about Elvis very much on the show, but there's three Elvis stories on the same day.
Yeah,
June
nuts.
26th. The birth of Colonel Tom Papa, Elvis's
Parker.
Last show.
Elvis's last show,
and then his father,
his father's passing. Yeah.
Dun dun dun. So moving on in 19. June 27th, 1960. Jake, you're gonna have to do this one too.
Oh, I've got to do this one.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm glad. I'm happy to do this one. 1960. Somebody's Fool hits number one on Billboard's Hot 100, and that made Connie Francis the very first solo female performer to have a number one hit. Which would be a really big deal But how long had Billboard been out at that point? Like 11 years, maybe?
Yeah, not very long. Not exceptionally long, so. But
still
over
a decade.
I honestly can't place that song. The name, the title eludes me.
Everybody's somebody's fool.
I don't know. I'll have to listen to it again. I've got a great memory for songs.
I feel like that's
it's just
how Jake sings things.
But you know me, like I can't connect names to the sound, and so it's like I've got to hear the song, and then it's like, oh yes, I remember this now.
Yeah.
So.
No, it turns out the way I sing everything is just how Lionel Richie would sing it.
Oh, jeez.
I'm just saying.
I can hear it.
All right. So here we go.
Yes.
1970.
Mm-hmm.
The band Smile.
Yep.
Who?
One of the most underrated bands of all time.
Really?
Yeah.
Yep, most underrated.
Mm-hmm.
We've mentioned the band once already.
Mm-hmm.
Have we?
Because it was on June 27th, 1970, the band Smile changed their name.
To
The Amazing and Wonderful Queen.
The Amazing and Wonderful Queen or just Queen?
Just Queen.
Ah, see, that makes more sense.
So Queen...
Yes.
Then goes on to become the uber-popular band that they became, producing so many freaking awesome albums, so many great songs, basically creating, like, anthem rock as we know it with We Will Rock You, which is, like, the most played song at sports events ever, next to Charge. Like,
let's be honest, they play We Will Rock You more than they play that.
Or that Gary Glitter song.
You know, they've been playing a lot of Bon Jovi, like at different sporting events that I've seen.
Like Living on a Prayer and that kind of stuff.
Yeah. They like to always pan to the crowd and stuff. But we actually had this conversation at work today of, you know, if you could go back in time to one concert, you know, who would you want to go back and see? And one of the guy goes, Queen Live Aid. Because that's them. That's Queen. Like, just rocking out hardcore in the daytime, no less, to like 100,000 people at Wembley Stadium. And that's the one with like where he's decked out in the white wife beater and the white pants, and he does that, you know, they're like da 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 da, that whole bit
for sure.
Love that. And then on top of that, I mean, just some of the best like moments of Queen were all sort of compiled together in that one concert. I would love to have seen that, like actually been there.
Now that you bring that up, that's actually a really interesting question, and now I'm curious what your answers are.
Oh, for the which one would I love to go see?
Yeah, like
that's easy.
You could go back in time.
If I could go back in time to any concert or I guess / festival, I would go back to Monterey Pop. It's 67, greatest concert of that I've ever seen. Like, in any format. Like,
okay.
Obviously, I wasn't alive in that time period.
But if you could.
But the documentary that was done for the Monterey Pop Festival just floored me on how good that concert actually would have been. Like, the entire couple of days that they did. I mean, you're talking about, like, the Mamas and the Papas setting it up. And, of course, this was after they already broke up. So it was the Mamas and the Papas. They get bands like Otis Redding, Big Brother and the Holding Company, you know, which is Janis Joplin rocking out and nobody had ever really heard of her at that time. A bunch of other like bluesy bands and stuff that ended up going on and doing some amazing things. But originally they tried to get the Beatles to play there, and this would have been, you know, 67. So the Beatles had like stopped touring and like they were really experimenting with their music. They couldn't make it because they were like, our music's too complicated to play live now, so we can't really do that. But Paul McCartney goes, well, you know who you should get? Some other friends of ours, a band called The Who.
Yep.
And another band called Jimi Hendrix Experience. First time that these two bands were introduced to the American public was at Monterey Pop Festival.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Wow. So you've got all of these just stellar performances from these bands for like the first time. On top of that, you've got amazing performances from all of these other already established bands. People in the crowd like include the Monkees and, you know, like Brian Jones from the Rolling Stones and like,
for sure,
like all of these other people. And, like, Ravi Shankar was there, who played, like, an entire afternoon, which was crazy.
So, say, like, talk about inspiration, right?
Yeah. So, for me, easy. Monterey Pop Festival 1967 is the one, like, concert that I would love to go back and actually see for real.
Already?
Jake, do you have one?
Yeah, I was going to say,
Jake. Yeah, I do. We've covered it on the show before.
Which one is that?
The British magazine.
Oh, yeah.
From the 60s. I can't remember the name of it now.
I remember, we talked about it on the show where it was like every major British group at the time in like the early 60s.
Yes.
Was playing together on one stage.
I think, it was the year 62.
It was like 62 or 63.
Right. I mean, it was the Beatles and the Stones and Eric Burdon and the Animals.
Oh, wow.
I mean, literally everyone was
there. It was every major British rock group that became huge.
Yeah, everybody but the Beatles played two songs, and the Beatles played four or five.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the most insane thing ever.
Do you have a concert there, Carl?
Okay.
Oh, great. You got to think about this.
No. I have two options.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is... obviously, the Hendrix live with the Band of Gypsies, I believe that was actually his army buddies that he played with, was the Band of Gypsies.
That I do not know, actually.
No,
I'm sorry.
Because the Hendrix experience, because Hendrix himself was American, and then he went over to Britain, and that's where he met the bass player and the drummer for the Jimi Hendrix experience, which is why a lot of Americans
Which is
hadn't
very,
actually heard
very rare
it.
To find other white guys who can make afros like that.
True. But Band of Gypsies, the bass player and the drummer that played in that, it was also a trio group. I've got the actual album that's a live recording of their
I need to watch set. That biopic.
Yeah.
Of about Jimi Hendrix. Who's it star? Andre 3000 or whatever?
I think so. I don't remember.
Something like that, yeah.
I've
heard it's okay.
There's a billion PBS specials about him, too. hey, man, I was raised on PBS, so...
True.
But yeah, no, like Band of Gypsies, I believe, was actually like whenever he was touring in the army, that was actually like his group that they would jam when they were on base.
Nice.
And then he got back together with them after the Hendrix experience. I guess I don't know. I don't remember them really having a falling out. I don't know if there was anything about that, but I don't remember them really breaking up either. Like,
yeah, I'm not sure. I honestly don't know that much
like,
about
the
it.
The end of his life was just kind of muddy, I think.
That is true.
The other concert that I wish I could go back and see, and you're going to not think this is important, and that's fine. There was a punk rock club in the 1980s called, I believe it was called City Garden in New Jersey.
Oh, okay.
And there's a documentary and there's a book about it called No Slam Dancing, No Stage Diving, No Spikes. And I have not been able to find a copy of the book anywhere, despite my efforts. Damn you, Books a Million. I haven't been able to find the documentary yet either, because I think you had to, like, there was, like, a bunch of special orders or something, because it was, like, a kickstarted thing, I think, unfortunately. Jake, what are you doing?
Jake, why are you playing music?
What you doing, Jake? Turn that off.
Yeah, because it ain't me. I ain't playing music.
Sorry. So John Stewart had Gibby Haynes of the Butthole Surfers on to talk about the book and documentary along with the author of the book. I cannot remember her name now. She was a manager at the club at one point in time, and John Stewart's first job was bartending at the club.
Ah.
So the first night he worked there, it was like 1979 or 1980. I don't remember date, month, whatever. But it was the Butthole Surfers opening for the Dead Kennedys, and those are two of my favorite punk bands, and I just wish I could have actually, like, just seen that. I've always wanted to, like, you know, be in that kind of era of music, because that's kind of what I identified with way too much when I was in high school, so.
Nice.
New Music Express, 1965.
Yes,
New Music
right.
Express, okay. That's the...
Run through the list.
Please.
Okay, here we go. No particular order. Well, okay, in alphabetical order. Cilla Black, Donovan, Dusty Springfield, Freddie and the Dreamers, Georgie Fame and the Blue Flames, Herman's Hermits, The Sounds Incorporated, The Animals, The Beatles, The Ivy Leagues, The Kinks, The Moody Blues, The Rolling Stones, The Searchers, The Seekers, Them, and Wayne Fontana and the Mindbenders.
Damn.
I mean, Freddie and the Dreamers.
Yeah, I know. But dude, seriously,
I'm
like
telling you now.
The Kinks, The Moody Blues, Rolling Stones, The Beatles, The Animals, and Herman's Hermits? because that's who I would either see. I mean, then you throw in Herman like, Terrence, oh, and by the way,
they had a following.
We all forgot that Dusty Springfield was there.
Yeah. Don't forget Cilla Black either.
Yeah.
I
mean, well, yeah.
That's insane. You said, what year was this?
1965, yeah.
Yeah.
New Music Express, they had like a, they would take a reader's poll every year, and whoever like made it on the bill, they would invite. And in 1965, everyone just decided to show up.
Well, was that, was that like, that's like Woodstock, like.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Woodstock was 69.
Yeah. Well, no, but I'm saying like that kind of collection of talent there.
Yeah.
Man, that's
nuts. That's
one
of the reasons why I like the Monterey Pop Festival more than I like Woodstock, because like Woodstock was sort of it was all after Monterey Pop, and so it was like, okay, you know, you guys are doing your cool little thing, but this one was so much cooler.
Well, a lot of bands also didn't go to Woodstock because they didn't think it was going to take off.
Yeah,
from what I remember, from what I've read, because I was totally alive in '69. No. Jeez. What is the next thing? Oh, man. 1994.
Go ahead and read that one, Carl.
All righty.
Okay. You
pause
there for a second?
No, sorry. Calm down, Brian.
So
1994, the year I was born. Don't I feel old now?
It's only 12 years after I was born and Jake was born.
Oh, I didn't know you guys were the same age.
Yep.
I thought you were like a year off or something.
No, we graduated together.
That doesn't mean you're not the same. Anyway, come on. All right, so 1994, Aerosmith became the first major band to let fans download a full new track free from the internet.
Yay! It only took like 30 minutes for the one song.
The internet, not just for porn.
Back when it was all dial-up and everybody had the AOL discs.
Oh, man, we had dial-up at my house until I was like 13.
Sounds about right. We had dial-up well into the age of DSL at my house, but that's fine. We ended up getting it later, and I was like, yay, I can download all of these songs now. It's so much quicker.
So legal.
That's not true, actually. I refuse to download music. I'm not a music thief. That is true. I much refuse to download music.
That is fair. All righty.
The only times that I've ever downloaded anything was when I already owned the album. So.
Oh, man. All right.
Yep.
Who's taking this
last
one?
Let's see. Last one. I'll go ahead and do it.
Do it.
In 2002, one day before the scheduled first show of The Who's 2002 U.S. tour, bass player John Entwistle died age 57 in his hotel room at the Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Las Vegas. I have seen the Hard Rock Hotel in Las Vegas. It is.
I have seen pictures.
It's a pretty cool joint. Entwistle had gone to bed the night with a stripper who woke at 10 a.m. to find Entwistle cold and unresponsive. The Las Vegas medical examiner determined the death was due to a heart attack induced by an undetermined amount of cocaine.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess at least it wasn't the sex that got him.
Well into 2002, man was rocking the drugs.
I mean, he was 57. That's fine. It's fine.
Yeah.
It's not really fine.
Okay, so this is one of those like human condition quandaries. Can you tell me why, like, being 57 and bedding a stripper is like really cool, but dying with a stripper is really sad?
Oh my god.
I can't explain it.
I'm going to tell that one to my coworkers.
I can't really explain it. It's just a thing that it's just a thing that is.
Oh, man.
Jeez, okay.
Cannot believe that. Let's move on to 28.
On to June 28th.
1968. Here we go. Aretha Franklin appears on the cover of Time magazine and is the first black woman to do so.
I think. I can't completely confirm that.
Well, I'd like to think it's true.
Yes. Do you know who was on Life magazine at the same time?
No, who?
Jefferson Airplane.
Oh, wow.
I only mentioned that because like Time and Life were both run by the same company.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So every issue you would have, or the next issue after, you would have interviews and stories of like the same people. There was a lot of crossover because they're owned by the same company.
Now, I always get thrown off on this. Was it actually Jefferson Airplane at the time that they did the Alice in Wonderland tune?
68. So I don't know when that album came out, but didn't they play it?
I always and I I'm,
yeah something I'm, like that.
I always, yeah. Well, it was all on the air in '69 during the Summer of Love.
Yeah, it was.
So, like, cause what's was it's the Go Ask Alice? I think she'll know. Is that the lyric I'm thinking of? Is that the right
talking
song?
About White Rabbit?
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. That,
Do,
so they actually were still Jefferson Airplane?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Who later became Starship Red.
Oh, God.
Oh, we love to bring up Starship on this show.
Sorry, I love that.
And by
I
love,
really love that
I mean,
song.
I love to bring it up and watch Jake mm-hmm. just sort of recoil in fear.
And
is it like
and throw up a little.
Choke back my dinner?
Oh, man.
Yep, that's how it goes.
Ooh, okay.
But, yeah, no, I mean, obviously we've talked about Aretha Franklin before
yes.
on this show. I mean, she was a singular woman in music history. Like, nobody honestly will ever truly compare to her. So,
but we must not forget that she refused to serve Jake and Elwood two chickens.
Have you seen the movie?
I thought she refused. I thought she didn't want to serve them.
Jake, what does he want? Four fried chickens. And
oh,
a Coke.
Four fried chickens.
And
I'm
some
sorry.
Dry white toast. Four fried chickens and a Coke.
I messed up the number.
God just... dang, Carl. How dare you sully that movie.
I was on a mission from God.
Light
and
meat
I
or
failed.
Dark meat? Four fried chickens.
Four fried chickens.
And a Coke. You want chicken wings or chicken thighs?
Four fried chickens
and a Coke. And some dry white toast, please.
Then a rubber biscuit off
we
of that
got...
One.
Two honkies out here dressed like Hasidic diamond merchants.
Yeah.
And one of them wants four fried chickens and a Coke.
Jake.
And the other one's dry white toast. Elwood. The Blues Brothers.
That's my favorite scene in the movie, and I butchered him. Sorry.
Wow.
I'm going to go commit musical seppuku.
That's
all
right.
That is.
Because the greatest rock and roll song ever recorded on this day premiered in theaters. I'm talking none other than C.W. McCaw's Convoy. The film premiered in Los Angeles starring Kris Kristofferson as an Arizona truck driver named Rubber Duck and also Ernest Borgnine as Sheriff Cottonmouth. The film was a very moderate box office success. However, did you know, Brian, that the 1977 Mack truck RS7 12 LST tanker truck used in the film for all the road scenes is currently on display and the only surviving one known of its kind at the St. Louis Museum of Transportation?
I did not know that.
Now you do.
The more you know.
The more you know.
Boom!
Yeah, that's the sound effect.
Nice. I like that. That's a great little fact there, Jake.
That was pretty extensive.
That's pretty stellar.
You actually did your research.
Oh, yes.
I appreciate that.
Look, when we're talking about 77 Mack truck tankers, and if you want to know, the tanker truck was like a package that they put together specifically for tankers.
Oh,
it
yeah.
had like mm-hmm. a slightly larger sleeping cab because tankers don't go as far over the fifth wheel, and very specific boxes to fit hoses in that were,
mm-hmm.
and the only one surviving is at that.
Nice.
Is at the Museum of Transportation. And
random,
it was used in the movie Convoy.
Random side note.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever seen trailers in Canada?
Yes.
I have not.
They have completely different axle setups.
Really?
Yeah. It's really funny because you see just like a row of tires on the side of the car or of the trailers. Fascinating stuff.
That's awesome.
I love it because, you know, when I was there last week, it was like I was pointing out to Jessica. Be like, hey, look. The trucks are even different. It's funny. Okay, so Jake, you've been
yes.
talking about this next one.
Yes, I have.
All night.
Yes, we have.
You were super excited about this one.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Go ahead and enlighten me on who this person is.
Okay.
Because I think I know, because mm-hmm. I think I remember reading about this person.
Yes.
But I just go off on it.
You should know, and you should know, and you listeners should know that on this day in 1993... none other than G.G. Allin himself died of a heroin overdose, finally.
Finally. I like the finally at the end there.
Because G.G. Allin, known more for his antics, stage presence, and dedication to debauchery, was not so much known for his music, as we will soon see.
I
Yeah, so you can see he didn't really have a whole lot to say in his music, did he?
No.
What just... punk artist really did, though?
Lots of them.
A lot of them. Yeah. Let's talk about...
That sounds like
everything the Clash did. I know. Sex Pistols even had God Save the Queen. And I mean, the Ramones...
fascist regime?
Yes.
The Ramones even had their own, like... cool way of doing it, you know. It's like
it was intended as a joke. I'm sorry, it didn't come off sarcastic.
No. No. We're giving you trouble. But Gigi Allen was born Jesus Christ Allen somewhere in the hills of New Hampshire.
Wow.
His father was an absolute freak who his mother divorced when Allen was 6 years old. His older brother could not pronounce the name Jesus, most likely because of the trauma inflicted by his father. When his mother tried to leave him, he kidnapped Allen and was kind of just kidnapped by his dad and under constant threat of being, like, just murdered unless his mother came back couple of weeks. But eventually they moved, and she changed his name to Kevin.
Kevin Allen.
It's However, his brother, like I said, couldn't say Jesus, so he would say Gigi, and that's where the nickname came from.
Got you.
Anyway, later in the 80s, Gigi Allen became a stage act and a punk artist who was most known for shitting himself and rubbing it on his face, otherwise known as Cooperphilia.
Oh, that was him?
That was him, yeah.
Okay.
So in 1993, he did an act very much like that, was kicked out of his own show by the venue for breaking too many things and just generally being an asshole.
And pooping on too many things, of course.
He then walked across the street to a liquor store that was closed naked. someone volunteered clothes for him. They then walked the town, broke some windows, had general riots, then went over to his buddy Johnny Puke's apartment where he spent the night doing heroin, and then in the morning was unresponsive, and when ambulances arrived, they pronounced him dead at the scene.
Wait, Johnny Puke from...
from... just New York.
Oh, okay. Sorry. No, I'm
sure it was.
It's not
he was,
Johnny Rotten.
No. I'm sure he was in some kind of band. He might have been in Allen's band at one time.
Something like that. No.
But, however, also very well known for how awesome his funeral was. His funeral kind of became a really rowdy party.
Of course.
As per his brother's wishes, his body was not embalmed, preserved, or washed or makeup. He was dressed in a leather jacket and his trademark jockstrap.
Nice.
And everyone spent the evening just getting wasted and lit and then just throwing random alcohol and drugs into Allen and posing with his corpse and taking pictures.
That's like early death metal shit.
About 10 years ago, his tombstone was removed from the graveyard where he was at because fans would come by and shit on it and piss on it. So, yeah, Gigi Allen, real class act, and 36 was too young for Allen, maybe? I don't know.
He's probably too old, honestly.
Probably.
Well, because that sounds, that song you played, when did that actually come out?
Oh, geez. That one, I don't know.
You know what it reminds me of is like the early Descendants recordings.
Okay. They cut a lot of demos, recorded a lot of things live, and then released them like years later. So that could have been recorded in like 86 or 88 and was probably released in the early 90s.
Okay.
Somewhere around 91 is where he started to shave his head and cut himself on stage. And that was when he started doing the Jerry Springer and the Tay Diamond talk show circuit.
Yeah.
And that's kind of when Allen made it in the mainstream of American culture. Up until that point, he was just kind of a subculture weirdo.
Bite it, you scum.
There you go.
Yeah. Can I do the next one?
What is the next one? Sure.
It's one of my favorite albums is what it is.
Go for it.
So in 1997, on the 28th of June, Radiohead went to number one on the UK album chart with their third album, OK Computer, which has, the Subterranean Homesick Alien, Paranoid Android, and all those good songs. Let's see. Sorry. First self-produced album, later appeared in many critics' lists and listener polls for the best album of the year, and also won a Grammy for Best Alternative Music Performance.
Yep. Also, it's one of those albums that, like, practically everyone I know owned at some point in time. And, like, that's generally one of their, if not their favorite, Radiohead album.
That was how I introduced my parents to Radiohead. I made them go out and buy that album.
See, my wife is a huge Radiohead fan.
That makes sense.
And she is constantly, like, listening to whatever they currently have out. Like, so
did she ever listen to Tom York's solo project?
Oh, yeah, The Eraser?
Yeah.
Oh, she loves it. She's got, like, the album, like,
track,
the vinyl. So.
Track 5 or 6, The Clock, is, like, my favorite on that album.
So I always just liked the main song, Eraser. So
it's all good. I just really like the guitar work in The Clock. It's just these really wonky chords and very nice syncopated rhythm.
Yeah, yeah. So here, let me go through, like, OK Computer, their track listing here. Just
see, it opens up with Airbag, right?
Let me get down to the actual one. Airbag, Paranoid Android, Subterranean Homesick Alien, Exit Music, Let Down, Karma Police, which is
a Karma
brilliant
Police,
song.
That's the one I forgot. Dang it.
Fitter Happier, Electioneering, Climbing Up the Walls, No Surprises, Lucky, and The Tourist.
No Surprises.
Seriously, seriously good songs.
Have you ever, the story behind the music video for No Surprises?
No.
That's the one where he's Tom York's wearing the astronaut helmet, and then, like, whenever it comes to the guitar solo, they fill up the helmet with water. And he sat in there for, I think, it was, like, roughly, like, 15, 20 seconds or something with just this water in there, and he had to, like, hold his breath for, you know, it was, like, almost a minute or something.
Wow.
And then they flushed it back out because they had to, what they did was they originally wanted, they tried getting him to hold his breath for the entirety of the solo, which I think is a... Actually, no, okay, I'm sorry. It was only about 15, 20 seconds because they tried getting him to hold his breath the entire time and he couldn't do it. So they had to slow down the footage at that point in the video, and then they just gradually speed it back up to normal motion. And I still don't catch where it actually shifts every time I watch the video. It fascinates me. No, that's probably my favorite of their albums. My second favorite has got to be It's Somewhere Between In Rainbows and The Bends.
Now, I've listened to In Rainbows a lot, just because, like I said, Jessica had it, and she would, like, constantly had it on.
Weird Fishes, man.
In her car. But here's the thing that I never really liked the album until we went on a trip one time,
mm-hmm.
and she decided to put it on, and we were driving through, I forgot where we were, but we were driving through someplace, and it was at night, and I'm driving along listening to In Rainbows, and it was like that's when it clicked for me.
Okay.
That's when I was like, wait a second, this album is actually really, really good. Just I never really got it before that moment. And then once I got it, I was like, okay, yes, this album's brilliant.
Well, talking about Aerosmith putting out the first online downloadable single, In Rainbows was the first album that a band put out and I believe it was the first album that a band put out and actually had fans name the price online.
Yes, you could pay what you wanted, and they still made a ton of money off of that.
Oh, yeah.
Because practically everybody paid at least $10.
Well, have you ever heard the conspiracy that follows around In Rainbows and OK Computer?
Uh-uh.
So there's a very large fan theory. There's a whole the collection on YouTube of it, and I think it's called, like, the Magic Tens or something like that. And basically, because... Fitter Happier is technically a hidden track. So if you take the main 10 tracks other than that out and you how many tracks were on OK Computer again? I'm sorry.
Let me look. I don't have up anymore. Sorry, I closed it.
Oh, no, you're fine. I'm just I want to make sure I'm actually getting this right.
12.
Okay, sorry. So it's 12 tracks. So it's 12 tracks including track 7.
Yes.
Okay. So then it's 11 tracks is what I'm thinking of. So the whole theory is that I believe In Rainbows also only has 11 tracks on it. And the idea is that if you take the first track from each album, then the second track from each album, third track from each album, and with an 11-second crossfade, it's supposed to, like, supposedly is this whole other album experience or whatever. And there's a whole thing online about this. And
weird.
I've listened to it once, and they flow together pretty flawlessly. It's actually quite impressive. because they came out like 10 or 11 years after each other.
Yeah.
Even.
So I've always liked it when bands do those types of things, like the really sort of long view of album creation,
yeah,
and it becomes more of an art form for them. But I'm also a huge fan of Hidden Tracks.
Right.
And to this day, though, like most of the time I see Hidden Tracks are at the end. You know, it's
usually,
like there's a bit of silence and then there's like, you know, a something hidden at the very, very end of it. But the best Hidden Track that I ever heard was for it was for the X-Files, like not soundtrack, but it was called Songs in the Key of X. And it was basically songs that the writers and stuff just happened to like. And so they put it together. But one time, I mean, my brother and I, we listened to this album a lot. And we found out because randomly the CD player skipped in his car one morning and it started playing a song that we didn't recognize.
Mm-hmm. Oh, nice.
And we were like, where in the world is this happening? And we looked at it and the numbers were negative. So it was counting. It was counting down as opposed to counting up, like most players would do. We figured out that if you play song one and then you hold the reverse button, it goes backwards. And there were two hidden songs in negative time on the. I was blown away.
Oh, that's amazing.
I was like, "How in the world is that possible? And when can I do this on my album?"
My personal favorite hidden track is. I don't know if you're familiar with the Meat Puppets at all.
Yeah, I know.
It's like Kurt Cobain's like apparently like favorite band or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It's off the 1993 album Too High to Die. They did the original version of Lake of Fire, which I think it was on this. The original release was on the same album with Plateau, which was also covered. Well, both songs were covered by Nirvana in the MTV Live. But at the end of Too High to Die, there's about a 10-15 second long break, and then it just goes into Lake of Fire, but it's like a sped up version. It's kind of interesting. That I could go on about that forever. That album was actually produced
I had to explain to a guy I work with who's 24 last week what hidden tracks were.
So,
cuz like if all you ever know is music from iTunes. iTunes.
They don't have real tones.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, listen to me, the old man. You kissing your iTunes. you don't know about no hidden tracks, do you?
No,
you want to know something, though? I knew about hidden tracks because my dad talked about one that I thought was absolutely brilliant, too. And you know what it was? It was a Monty Python album. It was a comedy album.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just them doing sketches and stuff like that, but it was this thing. So what it was is that my dad said that he listened to the album like a bunch of times, thought it was hilarious, you know, cool. And then somebody like bumped the record player and it skipped and it started playing something that they hadn't heard before.
Yep.
And so what it was is that it had two grooves.
Oh, nice.
On the record. And so if you played it from starting from one point, it would play one groove. If you played it starting at another point, it would play the second groove. Completely different stuff, same side of the record.
Oh, yeah.
Jack White's been doing a bunch of that shit lately, too.
That sounds awesome. I would love to do stuff like that.
No, that's fantastic. It's like the infinite loops on the end of vinyls and stuff, too, where it just keeps regrooving itself.
Yes. Yeah. So moving on, also on 1997, here's a quick one for you. Pink Floyd's album, The Dark Side of the Moon, spent its 1,056th week on the U.S. album chart. It was rumored at the time that if the album was played while watching the Wizard of Oz movie and started exactly when the MGM lion roared the third time during the movie's intro, that very interesting connections could be made between the two.
Weak. I believe you're missing the weed in that statement.
Where's that at?
Isn't that the whole thing? You're just supposed to be high when you watch it or whatever? I don't know.
Oh, well, you didn't.
You can be in any state of mind when you listen to Pink Floyd, and
it's
awesome.
Yes, but I thought the whole thing, the whole Wizard of Oz thing, everyone in my generation was like, it only works if you're high, man. I'm like, okay.
That doesn't even make sense,
I was
but okay.
Like, but okay. Like,
yeah. But 1,000 weeks, not days.
1,000 weeks.
So here's kind of the funny thing for me is that
1,056 weeks.
That Dark Side of the Moon. So I've listened to every song on Dark Side of the Moon.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I've never listened to the album in its entirety.
How?
I deliberately, like, for the longest time, didn't do it because, and I still haven't to this day. But like I said, I've heard every song.
Because you were watching Wizard of Oz too much.
I've heard every song. I've just never actually sat down and like listened to the album from start to finish. And the reason why is because I had seriously all of these hardcore like Dark Side of the Moon fans who are just like, it's the greatest album of all time. And the moment you say that to me, I'm going to believe that you're not telling me the truth. And so therefore, I don't listen to it.
It's one of the greatest albums ever printed, I'll say. I can't say it's the greatest of
again,
all time.
But then again, I've also never been huge into like prog rock. And so...
Okay, that's fair.
So for me, it's like when people start getting into that stuff, like I like my stuff to sort of make more sense as far as like the music that I'm listening to.
Well, personally, as far as an album experience for Pink Floyd goes, I honestly believe that listening to the entirety of Wish You Were Here is a much more, much more fulfilling of an experience than listening to the entirety of Dark Side of the Moon, in my opinion.
Well, moving on though, 2012. Randy Blythe of Lamb of God is arrested for manslaughter in the Czech Republic.
Gee, imagine that.
Stemming from an incident 2 years earlier where Blythe pushed a fan off stage that resulted in the man's death. After making bail, Blythe returned to the Czech Republic in 2013 and was acquitted at trial and appeared, and an appeal was later upheld. So he got off.
Well, what do you expect from a guy whose band was originally named Burn the Priest? I mean...
Yeah.
What, you expect him to just go like pushing crowd surfers?
I don't
constantly?
Know. I don't expect any. I'm just saying I don't expect anything necessarily good out of it. I don't know how you get from Burn the Priest to Lamb of God, but you know.
I totally don't remember this. This was the first time I've ever heard of this story.
Yeah.
So
that's fair.
But let's move on to June 29th anyway, because I honestly don't know anything about Lamb of God. So
fair enough.
I just only know the one fact because I think it's. I just think the names are kind of funny.
I mean, it is what it is. So
sorry.
1974,
yes. Neil Peart replaces John Rutsey, and instantly everyone forgot about poor John.
I didn't even know that dude existed until just now.
Yeah, no. There's a documentary about...
I knew who Pete Best was.
Pete Best from the Beatles?
Yes. The fifth Beatle. The original fifth Beatle.
Original fifth Beatle.
Well, I thought he was the drummer before Ringo,
of which,
correct?
Actually, there was another Beatle, too. Just nobody really talks about it.
I thought Pete became like their manager
at some
point or something.
Is that like original Rays and famous Rays?
No. So
like the original fifth Beatle and the famous fifth Beatle?
Was Pete the original drummer before Ringo? Is that what I'm thinking of?
Yes.
Okay.
And he was replaced by Ringo at the behest of their manager.
Okay,
Brian Epstein.
I always have a really terrible joke about that, and I'm going to tell it.
Go ahead.
You can kill me or you cannot. Either way. I've always made the joke that, the Beatles had another drummer before Ringo Starr, and everyone goes, really? And I'm like, yeah, he knew one beat and Ringo knew two.
Wow. We actually had the discussion.
It usually gets a laugh, Brian.
We usually had... Well, I'm a Ringo defender, so
I'm sorry. I just
like a lot of people give him flack, like because he wasn't exceptionally flashy.
No,
you know, I mean, we talk about Neil Peart. Neil Peart is amazing. Neil Peart, hands down, I will flat out say it that he is the best drummer in rock history. I will say that.
Okay.
Okay.
I'm just saying, everything he did was perfect for the songs.
Okay, everything from that standpoint, yes.
He did fit so well within the music that it was just pristine. Yeah, there might be other people out there who were better at certain stuff or better at
different
styles and all of that.
Yes, but
at the same time, Neil was also the type of guy where, like, when he first sort of retired, he was like, you know what, I'm going to completely relearn how to play this instrument. Mm-hmm. And so he went to other masters and was like, teach me how to play the way that you play. And that's when he learned. Neil is a man who flat out could mimic Buddy Rich, which Buddy Rich is considered the greatest drummer of all time by most drummers.
I know. Gene Krupa.
Really?
Yes.
Really?
Gene Krupa could actually give you feel. Buddy Rich was just fucking fast.
No, Buddy Rich was amazing.
He was just fast.
Gene Krupa could basically hit a floor tom.
Bullshit. That's one fucking song, Brian.
I know, but I've heard the other ones too, which is the exact reason why he was kicked out of that band.
Jesus Christ.
Just saying.
You're really defending Buddy Rich right now.
I'm really defending Buddy Rich right now. The dude may have been a complete and total tool, but at the same time, he was amazing.
He was very fast. He was amazing. I will give him that he was fast.
I'm going to say you're both wrong and it's Max Roach, but we still need to move on to another story.
That's fair. I'm not saying I'm not saying Krupa's the greatest drummer of all time. I just like him over Rich. I'm sorry.
I'm just saying, going back to what I was talking about with Ringo.
Yeah, no, no.
That
yeah.
Ringo.
I'm sorry for the slander. You're allowed the defense.
Fit the Beatles exceptionally well,
yes.
Especially later on when they were getting into the more progressive stuff. Like the stuff that he played was perfect.
It fit the music. Yeah.
It fit the music, and that's what he was good at.
Yeah, and that's And Neil.
He wasn't flashy. He just played the music.
That's fair. I mean, like I think the reason that I enjoy Neil Peart as much as I do is because one of my favorite bands of all time is Primus, and one of their, or at least one of Les Claypool, the bassist, one of his primary influences is Rush.
Mm-hmm.
So if you go back and you kind of listen to how he plays, or it's the same setup. You know, you got a drummer, guitarist, and a bass player who's also on your vocals.
Mm-hmm.
The only difference is Les Claypool can't play a foot keyboard while he's actually playing his bass. So Geddy Lee's got a beat on that.
Yeah.
And Geddy Lee is amazing too. It just, you know, and there's Alex Lifeson, of course, phenomenal guitar player. So
every member of Rush is just a supreme
example of
their instrument.
Right.
So.
They're like the one band I can think of that's actually maintained being alive as a band as long as they have. Like, I don't think they've ever had like any giant spouts or anything, have they?
Well, I mean, Neil retired at one point, then they got back together, and then now he's retired again. So. Because he says he can't play anymore.
He claims. Carpal tunnel and all
that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But with Neil, I mean, it's with Rush, it's one of the reasons, of course, why they've stayed together for so long and they've, you know, still doing quite well is because basically they didn't do anything other than hone their craft. They didn't party. They didn't do anything.
They played.
It's like, and everybody else thought that they were crazy when they first started going on these tours with these other big bands because they're like, hey, you guys want to go party afterwards? And they're like, no. We're going to get a pizza.
Okay. We're going to go get a pizza and maybe have a beer.
Molson Canadian.
Molson Golden.
It's like, you guys saw that down here?
Either way. All right, so
going to the next
moving
one.
1984. On. 1984.
The year of George Orwell.
After one attempt and failing to cut a satisfactory video for Dancing in the Dark, the Boss cast Courtney Cox in a live shoot in St. Paul, Minnesota.
We're dancing in the dark.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
How bad was that first video that kind of like just mediocre dancing was so much better?
I don't know.
It had to have been terrible.
Well, I mean,
like, was the first video just like filming the Boss waking up in the morning and looking at a cup of coffee real?
Springsteen was very much against music videos.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Very much against them back in the early days of you know, MTV and stuff.
When MTV actually had music videos?
Yeah, he flat out did not want to make music videos. And a lot of the older guys didn't. I mean,
yeah.
You even look back in like the later part of the 80s and 90s and stuff like that. There, I mean, you had artists like Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers have a massive, massive album, and yet he hated having to make like five music videos for that album. Now, music videos are basically made like just to promote like the concert or the tours.
Yeah.
You know, it's like just so you can get traction on social media. Like, that's the entire reason why these things exist.
It's not so much an art form anymore.
It's not, at least not for like the pop artist.
Right.
But you bring up Radiohead again. Like,
exactly,
all of their music videos are just crazy awesome.
Yeah. And it's you know, you kind of get that with Tool a little bit too, but I don't know, that can also be like Tool's kind of.
I like those people who really experiment in the visual format when it comes to.
That's what I like about their music videos. They're like my favorite Tool music video is actually it's off their last album. It's the song track 5, The Pot. It's the whole thing's animated, but it's like it almost looks like, you know, like those pop up books with like the kind of moving parts or whatever. It looks like that, but it actually somehow works with the music still. It's just kind of like just. Kind of gritty, I guess. I don't know.
Nice.
I enjoy the style of the video.
You,
Moving on.
Yeah, you. No, you laughed at this one when you first read it, so go ahead and take it.
Oh, sorry. I just haven't heard that phrase in a while. So in 1985, metrosexuality is born when Mick Jagger and David Bowie record Dancing in the Street at Abbey Road Studio and shoot the video the same day.
And can I say, it's pretty obvious that that was a one-day shoot.
I hate that song. I hate their version of it, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, like, I always kind of liked the original version, obviously, just because it's, you know...
Let's say the original was Creedence, right? No.
No.
What am I thinking of?
Why do I want to say it was Martha and the Vandals? But that's not right. Either way, it was one of the early 60s, like, girl groups from, like, Motown or whatever.
Oh, okay. Sorry, I'm thinking of the wrong song. My bad.
Yeah.
Move
so,
on.
So... Yeah, they did their whole like cover of it for this, and I've never liked their version of it. Like,
Martha and the Vandals did it in '64.
What?
There was also
there
was a Mama and the Papas version too.
There is a Mama and the Papas version, but yeah, no, that's funny that it was Martha and the Vandals.
Creedence song am I thinking of?
Pulled that one right out of the air.
Run through the jungle. I don't know.
No, there's down on the corner.
No, that was Guns N' Roses.
What I'm thinking of.
Run through the jungle?
Running through the jungle. No, I'm kidding. Okay. I'm kidding. Like, I know it's Welcome to the Jungle. Jeez.
I you totally blew my mind for a second. I thought that there was a Guns N' Roses Creedence cover I never heard. And I was trying to think did Axl Rose like manage the spider web of legal battle to get to record that song and make money off it anyway.
Well, even after the lead vocalist from Creedence got himself sued over his own song. That's one of my favorite stories.
All right, let's see what we got here. Here we go. 1988.
Woo!
Brenda Ritchie, the wife of Lionel Ritchie, was arrested in Beverly Hills, California, after allegedly hitting the singer and a young woman after she found them in bed together. So she was released on $5,000 bail, and charges against her were eventually dropped because Lionel was caught in bed with another woman, and he was like, "Okay, I deserved that."
Maybe.
Jake, I didn't know your wife got arrested.
Yeah.
Seems like like Lionel Richie.
I could be so lucky. Well, that's true. But I tell you what, whenever she broke into her friend's apartment, her best friend's apartment, who mm-hmm. Lionel's bed was in.
Oh dear.
Lionel didn't have to say, "Hello, is it me you're looking for?" He probably knew. All right, that was the cheapest.
I'm just saying, it's one of those things that's kind of expected with rock stars. You know, it's like anybody who gets married to a rock star is going to have to be like, they have women just throwing themselves at them constantly.
We've all seen the Mark Wahlberg movie.
Yes. I'm just saying, like, Rock Star is an amazing film.
I love that
no
movie.
Better social commentary.
Steel Dragon is one of the greatest fake bands of all time.
The vocals, man. So good.
And I've actually heard the that guy who did
remember,
the vocals.
Yeah, I can't remember.
I've heard like his band because he's like Finnish or Swedish. I don't remember.
I think he's Swedish.
But yeah, his band like is just amazing.
Yeah, they're good. They're really good. No, let's be honest. The best rock commentary is obviously this is Spinal Tap.
Yes. Well, it's a mockumentary, so that counts. But then again, they also count as one of the greatest fake bands of all time, too.
Yeah. So,
and
I mean,
one of these days,
we're going to do
like an album review of This Is Spinal Tap. So
I have the album at home.
So that
it's
be,
got a very black cover, Brian.
Uh-huh.
It's like a reflective black.
It's black.
You should have seen the cover they wanted to go with.
I don't know. Maybe the best fake band ever is the Monkees. Ouch. No, seriously. I love the Monkees.
We do love the Monkees.
We do.
I rag on Ringo, and you just flat out rag on the whole band. Like.
Anyhow, 1994, Barbara Streisand completes a series of comeback shows at Madison Square Garden. Over the course of four nights, the shows are filmed and later cut together in a video album called The Concert.
And
those shows are still the highest grossing shows in the history of Madison Square Garden for
really?
A music act. Yes.
How'd that happen?
Well, you'll remember that Barbra Streisand didn't take the stage for like 40 years.
What?
Right?
That is true.
Barbra Streisand, really huge in New York, Manhattan, off-Broadway, and then had like a, 30-40-year battle with, as she put it, stage fright.
Well, it was like 35 years or something crazy.
Yeah, so like 1994, she came back and opened up, and that's like one of the highest grossing tours in U.S. history.
If you want to sell out a show hall, take another year off.
I guess, yeah.
Yeah. Oh man.
But what else happened in 94?
I'm actually interested in this one. 1994, Oasis made their debut on BBC TV's Top of the Pops, performing their new single, Shaker Maker.
So, okay. Do you know what Top of the Pops is, Carl?
I've not read too far into it. I know a very brief history.
So, Top of the Pops is a TV show on the BBC, obviously. And what it is that they literally just had bands come on and play, you know, whatever it happened to be. But Top of the Pops goes back, really far.
Did U2 start there too or something?
You can find a video of U2 playing, what was it, I Will Follow or Walk Away? I don't remember what the name of it.
Yeah.
You can find, them doing an early, early version of that song.
Yeah.
And they look like a bunch of douchebags. It's hilarious.
They were trying.
Bono was trying really hard
way
back
too
then.
Hard, yeah.
Like a puffy shirt and stuff, and it was just like, okay, you guys aren't a punk band, and I know you, but it just cracked me up.
Well, he looks like Seinfeld from that one episode with the puffy shirt.
Yes. So, but Top of the Pops goes back even further than that. It's a brilliant TV show.
Is it still going today?
I don't know. I actually haven't looked it up.
So is it? But there's
other shows that are doing similar things though, like Later with Jules Holland, which is one of my all-time favorite music shows. But it's sort of a similar thing. They would just bring on different artists to do some different stuff. So
it's not like as put together as say like the PBS does the Austin City Limits shows, where they have
No. They wouldn't have like a band playing the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
It would be just like, you know, oh, hey, here's, I mean, what was the name of the Midnight Express or something like that here in America?
Yes, Midnight Express.
So similar
no,
thing.
Was it Midnight Special?
Midnight Special.
Midnight Special.
So, okay. Yeah. So Midnight Special was kind of a similar thing in the U.S.
Have
where,
the Midnight Special shine a light on me. Sorry.
Lionel Richie's first
Where they would bring on different bands and like actually have them play, you know, like their hit song or whatever it happened to be.
No, that's fantastic.
So the fact that this was the first time that Oasis actually appeared on Top of the Pops is a big deal.
Yeah, that's insane because, I mean, I didn't realize they did it back to 94.
Oh, yeah, Top of the Pops goes back to like the 60s.
No, I meant Oasis. Sorry.
Oh, Oasis. Yeah. Once again, I know we've talked about a bunch of documentaries. Check out their documentary, Supersonic.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
And
I'm not saying that just because, I mean, I'm not like the hugest Oasis fan. But that documentary made me like them a lot more, and at the same time made me hate them a lot more.
Oh, so you know how NPR does the Wait Wait Don't Tell Me show and all that?
Yes.
They had one of their segments where they tell two or three different stories, and they have the contestant pick which one they think is the true one.
Yes.
One of the ones that was true was the two leading members of Oasis who are brothers apparently prank each other all the time, to a point that like they will explode on each other like in like rehearsals and shit, and then they'll just like storm off or whatever. But it's
they
like,
hate
it's
each
like
other right now.
Oh yeah,
yeah. They don't
and
talk to
and,
each
and
other,
and it's because of stupid shit pranks apparently that they pull on each other.
Well, that's kind of the coolest thing about the entire documentary that I loved. Is it's Supersonic? You know, is the name of the documentary. But the interviews that they do with them, it's actually them. It's
okay.
Them talking over, like, sort of the history of the band and everything. But Noel Gallagher, I believe Noel is the guitar player. It's Noel and Liam.
I think so, yeah.
But Noel actually, like, is on there, and he's talking about all this stuff of like, you know, people giving him flack for, like, their antics, people giving them trouble and stuff. And yet, at the same time, he's basically telling them and telling everybody else, it's like, look, it doesn't matter what I do. Doesn't matter what I'm doing off stage or any of that. He's like, the only thing I want to be known for, that I will be remembered for, is producing great music. And that's it.
That's fair.
He goes, I don't care about what anybody else is saying about me. It's like, I want people to be able to listen to my music, it's like, for the next 100 years. And honestly, I think they succeeded. Because Oasis is one of those bands that, like, I can go back and I can listen to Oasis albums. And it's like, this takes me right back. Takes me right back to the 90s.
My introduction to them was Champagne Supernova.
Yeah.
And that was like within the first year or so that I'd picked up guitar. So.
And they're simple chord progressions too. There's nothing super fancy about them.
No, but the solo work is fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's.
Yeah, if you get a chance to check out that documentary, Carl, I think
Supersonic.
Supersonic is the name of the documentary. So really good stuff.
Top of the Pops looks like it's still going.
Oh,
is it? It's been running ever since 64.
Yep.
I think their current theme song is "The Wizard" by Black Sabbath. Kind of interesting.
I remember seeing Freddy and the Dreamers on Top of the Pops, like on one of the many like mm-hmm. DVDs that I've mm-hmm. seen of Top of the Pops. Because for a while there, they had like best of the top of the pops, like, you know, the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And the 60s, you know, were pretty cool just watching all their stuff. The 70s were kind of cool, and the 80s were pretty cool. But what I thought was really funny is that Rod Stewart shows up randomly.
Yeah. The perennial Rod Stewart.
Like, he just shows up randomly with other bands. It's like, oh, hey, Rod Stewart happened to be here. Yeah, I'll sing backup vocals with you guys. Okay. Rod Stewart.
Yeah. But the really cool thing is that you can go to bbc.co.uk and they have an almost complete archive of videos that you can watch from mm-hmm. all the Top of the Pops.
Groovy.
Mm-hmm.
Let's move on to June 30th and close out this week.
Our last day. I want this one.
Go for it.
All right. 1951, Stanley Clarke is born in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. The acclaimed jazz bassist has worked with almost everyone in jazz. Just to name three of my favorites, Stan Getz, Chick Corea, and Pharoah Sanders. He's also one of the very few jazz artists to score like a real Billboard hit, like a top 20. That time he did it with George Duke and the song Sweet Baby.
George Duke from Frank Zappa?
It's the same.
Damn, son.
Mm-hmm. The falsetto hit, Sweet Baby.
Yeah, no, that's... Wow. Did not know that was...
Yeah, Stanley Clarke, heck of a bass player, one of my favorites.
Yeah, fantastic. I've heard that song, yeah. That's amazing.
Anyhow,
George Duke is one of my favorite keyboard players.
Oh, yeah?
I got way too into Zappa in the last like year or so. Yeah. And
you should go back and listen to Sweet Baby.
I've listened to that one before. Yeah. I honestly, one of my favorites of his is still his version of Uncle Remus,
mm-hmm.
which I don't remember which album that one was on. Of course, the Zappa version that he played on and co-wrote was on Apostrophe, but sorry.
Oh, just in closing on that, Sweet Baby, I really love because there's a lot of weird dissonance between, mm-hmm. and it's a duo. It's just George Duke singing,
yeah.
him playing a grand piano, and Stanley Clarke on an upright.
Bass, yeah.
Yeah, on an upright bass.
That's amazing.
And there's just weird dissonance and tension put in with crazy jazz chords and seven steps and going minor when you shouldn't.
Well, that's
and
yeah,
it still comes out as like a really good poppy, just kind of sweet ballad.
Duke was like an alchemist.
Yeah,
right? he just knew what the hell he was doing.
Yeah.
And I don't remember where he studied, but I know he studied jazz piano, and I believe he got a master's degree in it,
okay.
if I'm not mistaken. Don't quote me. Nobody quote me. Moving on.
Do not isolate that audio.
I got this one.
All right, then.
1966, the Beatles played the first of three concerts at the Nippon Budokan Hall in Japan.
Budokan Hall?
Yes. Budokan.
I've been to that con.
Oh, so the concert was filmed with the Beatles wearing black suits. The following day's first performance was also filmed with the Beatles wearing white suits. And there was a strict police presence with 3,000 police observing each concert played in front of 10,000 fans. That was 3,000 police officers for 10,000 fans.
So one officer for every 3.3 concert goers.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
For Japanese people, which are widely known for their respect.
True.
But who knows?
I mean, them Beatles, that British fever.
Mm-hmm.
Fascinating. That's one of those concerts that I thought would have been kind of cool to actually see. So those Japanese folks were...
Are you changing your answer from earlier?
No, of course not. No, I'm just saying, it's one of those concerts that I would be like, that would have been interesting to actually go see. Like,
fair.
Seeing the Beatles play in Japan in front of this crowd of 10,000 people.
Weren't they also, like, one of the first, like during the Cold War, they got really popular in the USSR at one point, didn't they? Like, that was a...
Kind of like anything that wasn't propaganda was popular in the USSR.
There's documentaries about, people would take... they would made bootleg recordings mm-hmm. of the records on old X-rays. is what they would do.
Russian music, man, cracks me up. Like, Russian pop music is pretty insane.
Yeah.
Especially, like, I remember watching this video, and it was like a BuzzFeed video, and it was really stupid, but it was like, people's husbands dress up as like their favorite boy band person, like from their teenage years.
Of course.
And one of the guys was like married to a Russian woman, and she goes, "Oh, I was a huge fan of this band, and I want you to look like this person." And so I looked up this band, and like there's a music video of theirs on YouTube. Mm-hmm. And it's basically like four or five dudes dressed sort of similarly, like in the boy band-ish like thing for Russia. And they're basically like just banging chicks.
There's a more recently in Russian pop music.
Like, there's no real point to the music video except for there's a bunch of crazy people.
Yeah.
And then each one of the main dudes is like, they're just like having sex with some woman.
Yeah.
I think the most popular or well-known Russian pop anything in the U.S. is probably the Trolololo guy.
I thought that dude was German.
No. That came out of the USSR.
Oh.
Yeah. There's actual lyrics that he wrote to that song that's about a cowboy coming home from like driving cows.
Yeah, that's what it's actually
right.
about.
But he was worried that the damn, what's their Secret Service in
KGB?
KGB, yeah. That the KGB would just take him, make him disappear.
See, now, funny it's you fair. Mentioned that
yeah.
because
so
I,
he just
I know
ad-libbed I've, all the noises, yeah.
yeah.
I know I've brought up, at least I believe I have, Vladimir Vysotsky.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So Vladimir Vysotsky was essentially the Bob Dylan in Russia. And he was brilliant. So he played guitar. He played it in sort of a traditional fashion. But the way that he sang, like he sang these great songs that were really about like interpersonal things, you know, like him dealing with drugs and like that kind of stuff. But at the same time, he was one of the only people who could actively speak out against the state and nothing would happen to him.
Yeah.
Wow.
Because of how popular he actually was with the population.
Wow.
You know else who could speak out against the state and no one could touch?
Who?
Chuck Norris.
Okay.
Have you never heard of the documentary Chuck Norris versus Communism?
No, I have not.
Okay. So there was
I know there's one about John Wayne.
Yes.
Yep.
No. That the John Wayne one is more like John Wayne like bullying people in the U.S. for being communist.
I mean, because there were actual plans drawn up,
mm-hmm.
like, by Russian dictators to kill John Wayne.
Yes. No. This documentary is about the bootleg market in Russia.
Nice.
During the 90s and the early 80s, and how there was a huge, just black market bootlegging operation where they would have people do voiceover and just put the voiceover on VHS copies of, so you're hearing the movie with somebody just speaking over the top of the movie. It's like really low rent, but it's still a super popular art form, I guess, in Russia till this day. But the most popular videos were all Chuck Norris because everyone Chuck Norris would roundhouse kick somehow was a communist. It didn't matter if it was in Cuba or you know, non-placeable Eastern European
Bruce
state.
Lee, Way of the Dragon.
Yeah, it's a fascinating it's a fascinating documentary. You should look it up.
Chuck Norris versus communism. I've heard that title. I thought that was a joke.
No,
okay,
it's great.
Not.
It's great.
All right.
They find the
Moving
lady.
On.
Yeah, it's great.
Moving
yes,
on
yeah.
to the next thing.
Go for this one, Carl.
I'm going to take this one. So 1997 on
77.
June. 1977. My bad. On June, was this 30th,
30th
right?
Yes.
Yes. June 30th, the Kiss comic book is published by Marvel Comics.
Mm-hmm.
I'm assuming that was just kind of a one-off thing. I've never read it. I just thought it was amusing because
there,
I read way
there
too many
was a
comics.
Gimmick to it. There was a gimmick to it.
Oh, yeah.
All four of the original members of Kiss showed up several months prior to the release of it to prick their finger and drop blood into the red ink that was...
Well, that's good.
Yeah. So I kind of see that moment as the absolute starting point, like the gunshot going off in the race that became the Satanic Panic of the early 80s in the U.S.
Knights in Satan's
service. Satan's service, yes.
Good Lord.
So yeah, the comic book was a really big success and kind of kept Marvel afloat for a couple of years, because just after that they declared bankruptcy.
That wasn't a good time for them.
And their stock was like a dollar a share.
Yep. All right. Nice. Jake, I think you should take this next one, because you were so excited about it.
All right. Here we go. 1990. New Kids on the Block started a three-week run. I can't do it. All right. At number one in the U.S. singles chart with Step by Step. I don't remember that song at all. The group's
one of their two hits.
The group's third U.S. number one, a number two hit in the U.K., and their album, Step by Step, also went to number one in the U.K. So transatlantic sharing of culture there. You're welcome, the United Kingdom.
You're so excited.
New Kids on the Block is one of those bands that everybody really just loves to hate.
Yeah.
But at the same time, they embrace it.
Well, I mean, here's
they're not like Nickelback. Nickelback's just like, we're a legitimate band. Yeah.
Look at this graph. You know,
look at this photograph. Yeah.
Have you not seen the edit of that? He just holds up a graph.
that is a really great comparison, Brian, because New Kids, as everyone remembers, had swatches at Pizza Hut.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And Nickelback has item menus at Denny's.
That is true.
Does anybody remember when Avril Lavigne divorced the lead singer of Nickelback?
Chad Kroeger.
Yeah, did you ever see The Onion? I think it was The Onion that put out the article. It was Avril Lavigne finally realizes that Nickelback is bad. It was my favorite one.
What? So, yeah, no, but New Kids on the Block, like, they know, like, they're sort of a niche kind of thing.
It's like if you know people like your material for being campy or bad, you're gonna go with it, right?
Yeah, exactly. So, but it just cracks me up because those guys appear on TV shows and stuff together, which is really fun.
Hey, at least Donnie Wahlberg was able to put together like a real career afterwards.
As a great actor.
He really is a good actor.
Yeah.
I mean, he looked like he was enjoying himself on that stage.
He was great on Band of Brothers.
Yes, he was.
So
Lipton.
Lipton. Sergeant Lipton.
Is that the brother that's in Blue Bloods now?
Yes.
Yeah, because he was also in NSYNC, wasn't he?
No. No, he was just in New Kids on the Block.
There was a Wahlberg brother that was in NSYNC, apparently.
No.
That was Marky Mark. Marky Mark and the Funky Bunch.
Yeah, that was he was by himself.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. All right.
And he did hip-hop.
Hip-hop.
Yes.
Oh, God.
Which is
now
why
I have that album
which is why
cover
at
in
the
my
end
head,
of Rockstar, when they're doing bloopers, he goes, it's not about this, and he throws up the devil horns.
Yeah.
He goes, you know, it's about this, and he throws up the West Side, you know, like.
I have that stupid album cover of him with the backwards cap and the Yankees jersey unbuttoned.
Is it like the cover of Blank Check, but Mark Wahlberg instead?
And also, remember, folks, that Mark Wahlberg was charged with a hate crime. So, for beating up an Asian guy.
Oh yeah, I forgot about that.
I didn't know that. That's
there
great.
There you go. We always.
I mean, it's not
we
great, but that's
remember.
Kind of funny.
I'll take the next one though.
Go for
Do it.
In 2009, people are crushed to death at a rock slide festival in Denmark while Pearl Jam was on stage. The wave of crowd surfing. A wave of crowd surfing bands pass over venues in Europe, and of course they released the song called Love Boat Captain in 2002.
All right, so the lesson that we've learned from this is that
don't listen to Pearl Jam.
No. Is that if Jake puts notes that are more than one or two sentences, only Jake should read them. Because I breathe.
But I need to read the next one.
Yeah, anyway, so there was a nine people that died at a festival while Pearl Jam was playing. A lot of people were crowd surfing.
Yeah.
And
I also misread that it says Rock Idol.
Yes.
I thought it said Rock Idol, Slide. Yeah. I don't know why it said Rock Slide.
That's, because that's not English, and you're an English-minded individual.
True.
So there you go. So your brain puts the dots together. Anyhow, yeah, so
I was listening to Danish music yesterday, actually.
Nice.
Was it yolking?
I don't know what it was. I don't know what they were saying because it was all in Danish, but it was still very interesting. Go ahead, continue.
Oh, yeah. So a barricade kind of like fell over And then a lot of people just got thrown into a pit.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, like all the crowd surfers just kind of like got thrown into the same sort of area. So it's kind of like front of the stage.
Like a not as bad, of course, as the Massacre, though, with The Who and Bob O'Reilly, right?
Yeah, kind of similar. But yeah, so Pearl Jam, actually, they stopped playing and tried to like verbally just separate the crowd. You know, you start walking over here, you start walking over here, but... You know, yeah, nine people died.
Jeez.
And later they released a song in 2002 called Love Boat Captain that was kind of about how the band felt about that.
Nice.
Interesting.
You know what, Jake? Go ahead and close this out.
All right. In 2001, and we always close out on a very somber note.
I don't know. The last one was pretty somber.
It was, but you know what? This one doesn't really get all that much better because American guitarist and producer Chet Atkins died in Nashville at age 77.
Did you just say Atkins?
Atkins.
Chet Atkins.
I did say Atkins.
You said Atkins?
It's fine.
Either
way. I said Rock Slide.
You're right.
That's fair.
Anyhow, he had recorded over 100 albums during his career, produced records for Perry Como, Elvis Presley, Don Gibson, Jim Reeves, and Waylon Jennings. He was a major influence on George Harrison and Mark Knopfler.
And if I'm not
Dire
mistaken.
Straits.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know, Mark Knopfler actually has one of five. Chet Atkins gave out pins that he dubbed of people he dubbed, I guess, worthy guitarists in his eyes. And Knopfler actually has one of them. I don't remember all the other three, but I know Jerry Reed, I believe, has one of them. Because I believe Atkins actually discovered Reed, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
It's
just one of these sad days, of course, with Chet Atkins, because he's such a well-known figure in the music world. It's like, he may not be known to every fan out there, but at the same time, like, every musician knows who Chet Atkins
is.
Oh,
for sure, yeah. No, I love his jazz recordings, honestly.
Absolutely.
Yeah, damn.
Yeah, so it's definitely a sad day.
Gotta get that Gretsch guitar.
And of course, he died in 2001, but it's still a loss that is felt just because of the sheer amount of impact that he actually had on the music industry.
I mean, it was a space odyssey.
Yes. It was.
How do we know he's not in the monolith? Just chilling out.
Just chilling out.
Playing some jazz.
All right, folks. That is the end of our show for this week in music history. It has been a blast talking over these things with you. If you want to check out our other programs, you can go to followthesoundpodcast.com, where you can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, Podbean, Google Play, and a bunch of other places. But if you like our podcast, hopefully you will like some other podcasts. So you can go to lineupmedia.fm and find some other really great podcasts out there. I mentioned one already, Surreal Talk. They do cult conspiracies and the paranormal. Hands down, one of the best shows on the network. I love these guys, and I love the stuff that they do. They have great conversations, really, really interactive with their crowd. So if you are into conspiracy theories or paranormal stuff or anything weird, check out this show. Toasted by Eric and Everett, and they are just two cool guys who put on a really, really fantastic show. But if you want to help out our show, you can go to followthesoundpodcast.com/Amazon, or you can click on the Amazon banner on our page. It'll take you to Amazon. You can do all of your normal shopping, and it won't cost you anything extra. But we get a little bit of money back just for the referral. It's a very simple way for you to help support this podcast. And, you know, it's really, really simple. So once again, you can go to the website and click on the Amazon banner, or you can go to followthesoundpodcast.com/Amazon. And that'll conclude it for this episode. I, of course, have been your host, Brian Kroc, and along with me, as always, is Jacob Crum.
That's all right, Mama. Just any way will do.
And Carl Stegeman.
Hello and goodbye.
Remember, if you hear it, follow the sound.
This podcast was a presentation of lineupmedia.fm.